Jill Coughlan used to be a TV producer and a classic, hard-driven, type A personality. She worked 10- and 12-hour days, frequently worked weekends, and in her time off, her life was equally full, dinners, movies, shows, hiking. Then she got breast cancer. In one sense, Jill Coughlan was lucky. She survived the cancer, but then came another problem. She fell into a debilitating fatigue for which her doctors had no ready explanation. That same kind of fatigue strikes tens of thousands of breast cancer survivors. As Frank Browning reports, medical researchers are beginning to suspect it has a lot to do with how our bodies either do or do not succeed at handling severe stress.
On the afternoon we spoke, Jill Coughlan faced a very heavy schedule. She had taken a nap that morning to prepare herself for the half-hour drive through suburban Sacramento traffic for our interview. 2 years ago, even that would have been unthinkable.
I was so fatigued, it would feel like if you had 1,000 pounds of bricks on your back, and all you had to really do was, you know, like walk out to get your mail or something like that. I couldn't do that. I couldn't read. I couldn't listen to music. It was like being in a tunnel or a hole that was so deep, I could not get out of it.
Coughlan still can't work, but she's beginning to pull herself out of that tunnel. Many breast cancer activists have blamed the inexplicable fatigue on radiation and chemotherapy used in treating the cancer or preventing its recurrence. And there may be some merit to the claim. But increasingly, researchers have begun to suspect that the body's own immune system may play a role in the fatigue following cancer treatment. Julie Bowers of the Neuropsychiatric Institute at UCLA has been looking closely at how the body reacts both to breast cancer and its treatment.
It's a significant problem in oncology. I mean, we find about 30% of women are reporting fairly significant fatigue. So we're really wanting to try to understand what's going on.
Bowers and her colleagues decided to focus on a set of immune system chemicals called cytokines.
Cytokines, I think of as the hormones of the immune system. They're basically the signals that immune cells use to help communicate with each other, to let each other know when there's some kind of infection or injury, some threat to the body. And they also are used for the immune system to communicate with other systems in the body, to let the brain know, hey, there's something wrong, we have an infection going on here. And that helps the whole body coordinate a systemic response.
It's like the response your body makes to having the flu. You're tired, out of sorts, lack much appetite, and carry a fever. All those responses are coordinated by the brain as a healing strategy once these cytokine messengers have reported some sort of assault on the body. It can be an infection, a wound, or even cancer. In each case, a variety of cytokines are released, and they trigger fatigue. And indeed, Bowers found that the fatigued breast cancer survivors showed cytokine levels about a third higher than normal survivors. Moreover, they also showed heightened CD4 T cells, key elements in fighting infection. And lastly, they found abnormal levels of cortisol, another hormone that is linked to mood. All of these, cortisol, T cells, and cytokines, are elements of everyone's immune system, and they are meant to react quickly when the body is under severe stress or assault. In most women, these chemicals return to normal levels, and the fatigue goes away. But what Bowers wanted to know is, what's happening in those 30% who didn't return to normal?
We know these cytokines can be triggered by cancer, can be triggered by cancer treatment. Maybe for some women, they are continuing to affect the brain and lead to these symptoms of fatigue.
So far, all she can point to is a relationship, not a cause. However, animal studies have shown that injections of cytokines consistently produce fatigue and listlessness. And when the cytokines are blocked, the animals behave normally. Which gets us back to Jill Coughlan.
Things started to change when finally a friend of mine, actually, who's a doctor, went back east to Yale for 3 days. They were doing some kind of medical thing with breast cancer patients, and they were finding that people were having good results with antidepressant medication. They didn't know why, because a lot of times they don't know why it works for a lot of things. She called me and she talked to me about it.
She went on antidepressants, and gradually her energy crept back. At Stanford University, David Spiegel has also been looking at fatigue, depression, and stress among breast cancer survivors. Particularly, he's been studying what happens to cortisol, a neurotransmitter hormone that tends to spike when we're under high stress.
Typically, your cortisol levels will be about 4 to 5 times as high in the morning as they are late in the day. However, there are certain emotional problems in which the cortisol levels are disrupted. So people who are depressed tend to have high cortisol levels throughout the day. People with post-traumatic stress disorder tend to have a kind of burnout pattern in which their levels are very low throughout the day. In both cases, they lose this nice daily rhythm, high in the morning, low in the evening.
Which parallels Julie Bauer's high fatigue, high cytokine breast cancer patients. But that's not the end of the story. Those high levels also bode poorly for the future, especially among women whose breast cancer returned but was being successfully treated.
And what we found is that we could predict mortality up to 7 years later. So the ones with the abnormal patterns peaking later in the day were likely to die sooner of breast cancer than the ones with the normal patterns. And this was independent of the usual prognostic variables in breast cancer.
How these chemical levels get disrupted is far from clear, but a raft of studies seems to link the disruptions to prolonged stress and depression. For some people, it may be internal immune malfunctions. For others, it may be a question of a person's social or work life. Spiegel has focused a great deal of his research on circadian rhythms, our internal waking and sleeping patterns, and what happens to cortisol levels when those rhythms are disrupted.
Some of it may be a maladaptive stress response. That is, there gets to be an interactive cycle where if you go to bed with a high cortisol level, you won't sleep as well. And if you don't sleep as well, you're likely to have disrupted cortisol patterns throughout the day. So some of it may be disrupted circadian patterns. Some of it may be the social isolation and stress that comes with illness. Some of it may be hormonal disruption that comes with treatment, with changes in diet and exercise that cancer patients and others have to go through.
Among those who suffer the greatest circadian sleep disruptions are women who have recently lost their mates.
This is the cortisol pattern of those breast cancer patients in our study who had lost spouses. And you see that it actually goes up at 9 p.m. when it should be going down. This is the normal pattern here. So the ones who had lost spouses have a 9 p.m. cortisol level that's 3 times as high as normal. The ones who are married have a little increase at 5 p.m. My guess is that's when their husbands came home and they had a bit of a cord increase. But clearly loss of social support is associated with this change in hormone rhythms. And these are the data showing that if you implant tumors in mice who have had disruption of their circadian cortisol patterns, the tumors grow twice as fast.
Among the women in Spiegel's study who suffer disrupted sleep and cortisol patterns, natural killer cells, the body's key weapon in killing cancer cells, decline sharply. In another study at the University of Iowa, Susan Lutkendorf has found yet a further interaction between prolonged stress and cancer. Lutkendorf has been looking at how 3 stress hormones, cortisol and 2 forms of adrenaline, norepinephrine and epinephrine, affect ovarian tumor growth. For tumors to grow, they must create blood vessels, and to do that, they have to generate a chemical called VEGF. Lutkendorf's question was, what do these stress hormones do to VEGF?
So we added stress hormones to ovarian cancer cells, allowed them to grow, and then tested the amount of this particular tumor growth factor, VEGF, and found that indeed norepinephrine and to a lesser extent epinephrine greatly increased tumor production of this factor.
Next, they treated the tumor cells with a beta blocker.
When we added a substance that blocks the effect of stress hormones, the level of VEGF produced by the ovarian cancer cells completely dropped off, suggesting that indeed it was the stress hormones that were causing that increase in VEGF in the ovarian cancer cells.
And thus enabling the tumors to make new blood vessels and grow. All that research was conducted in laboratory dishes, but Lutkendorf's team was also working with actual ovarian cancer patients.
We found among a small group of ovarian cancer patients that those who reported high levels of social support before they had surgery had lower levels of VEGF, and that people who were reporting higher levels of distress had higher levels of this substance.
The number of patients was small, and therefore not definitive, but it is consistent with David Spiegel's work at Stanford on the effect of stress reduction on recurrent breast cancer survival.
In a randomized trial, we found that metastatic breast cancer patients who participated for a year in supportive expressive group therapy actually lived on average 18 months longer than control patients. By 48 months after the study began, all of the controls had died and a third of the treatment group were still alive. Now, it didn't affect the ultimate outcome, but it sure affected the length of survival for the intervention patients.
Jennifer McLeod is one of the survivors. McLeod had her first mastectomy in 1987. And then suffered a recurrence 6 years later. She assumed she had little time left, but on advice of her oncologist, she joined David Spiegel's first study of how support groups affect breast cancer.
A lot of my friends say, why do you want to do that? It must be so depressing. It's been absolutely magic for me. It's been an opportunity to grow, to learn about my disease, to learn about myself. And most of all, I think women such as myself feel we have good friends. We have a support group. But you know, our family and the ones we love, they're terrified. And to be able to go into a room with women that are in exactly the same place you are, and to be able to talk about that fear and how terrified you are and learn how to deal with it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I've learned how to cope with my disease. I've learned to turn around and look at that thing that sits on your shoulder that's called death, to turn around and look at death full in the face, and moved on with living. Look at death and then get on with living. And that's what the support group is all about.
That, she says, has done more to reduce the stress in her life and the stress she feels about her cancer than anything else. As one of two surviving members of the original support group, she has no illusions that support alone will prevent another recurrence. But it has changed the quality of her life and may have given her several extra years. For NPR News, I'm Frank Browning.